for this morning, United States versus Davis. Mr. Anderson.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I think that there one of the central disagreements between our position and the government's position in this case is what exactly the plea agreement required the government to do. And there are two pertinent paragraphs. Paragraph 17 is an agreement to limit an argument as to drug quantity. Paragraph 18 is an agreement as to limit the recommendation as to offense level. And I think those can be conflated because often they correspond. The drug quantity informs the offense level. And so I think when the government says they didn't breach their plea agreement here, they're mostly relying on the fact that they kept insisting, well, even though he's responsible for more than 280 grams, even though he's responsible for 512 or 2.8 kilos or 2.1 kilos, whichever these numbers they proffer, we still think that the offense level should be 30. That accords with paragraph 18, but it doesn't accord with paragraph 17. That's a breach of the plea agreement. Under the contract principles that this court looks to in interpreting a criminal plea agreement, the government is subject to all of the terms of that agreement. They drafted the agreement. There has been very strong language ever since Santabello, an automatic reversal rule when the government breaches the agreement. I think that we identified three breaches at the first sentencing hearing, in the revised version of the offense, in the third sentencing hearing. I don't see the government make an explicit argument that they cured the breach. I think that's maybe the tenor of the argument is, at the end of the day, we suggested 279 grams. And I think Diaz-Jimenez out of this court is instructive as to that, as well as Santabello, in saying that it has to be unequivocal. It has to be an assertion of, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. We unequivocally believe that this is the drug quantity. We unequivocally believe that you can't credit Mr. Davis with any more quantity than this, because perhaps the
What they did recommend, what they said they were going to do, right?
Well, I think that the language in the transcript is not unequivocal. Page 118 of the sentencing transcript, the government's saying very forcefully, the real amount here is 512 grams. The real amount is 512 grams. And Judge Clivert, I think, quite rightly says, well, how does this accord with the plea agreement? The government says, well, it's a mistake. We'll give you a wrong amount. We'll give you 279. But there's this implication that's not really the actual drug quantity.
He convinced Judge Clivert because he gave it substantially less than the recommended time, right?
Well, he gave 10 months less, right? I think Judge Clivert handled the situation almost entirely appropriately. I think in the first sentencing hearing, I think he jumped to a conclusion that Mr. Davis had somehow breached the plea agreement. I don't see the support for that, but I think that's right. The problem is this was an agreement between the government and Mr. Davis, and that agreement induced the guilty plea. It induced Mr. Davis to give up a variety of constitutional rights. And so the rule of automatic reversal from Santabello deals with not with what Judge Clivert did, or what Judge Clivert then decided. It has to do with whether the government honored the promises that it made. In terms of drug quantity, I think it's...
Well, but did the defendant honor it, too?
I think he did, and the government's given us no indication, either in the district court or on appeal, that Mr. Davis breached the plea agreement himself.
Well, somewhere I didn't recall reading, thought I read it, that he denied that there was no transactions.
No, I think that's a misstatement of what Mr. Davis's positions were. I understand it because he made many filings, he made many claims, but the theme throughout was he was coerced into a guilty plea, he received ineffective assistance of counsel, there is a Brady violation, there is prosecutorial misconduct, But there was never a claim from Mr. Davis that none of this happened. It was that none of the evidence that could put him above 28 grams was reliable. It was all tainted in his mind. That I think it's more an objection to the evidence that the government presented than an affirmative, I'm not guilty, I'm actually innocent, this, none of this ever happened. He wasn't willing to admit that more than 28 grams, but at the end of the third sentencing hearing, on page 117, Judge Clifford asked him point blank, so what are you responsible for? He says 28 grams. But this was anticipated in the plea agreement that he would object to this. He never agreed to a range of 196 to 280. Government said that's what we'll limit our recommendation to, but you know what he pled guilty to and what he contested at sentencing was 28 grams. So in any case, the
government... We had three sentencing hearings, you say?
Right. This was...
280 was represented when it was pro se?
Well, he was pro se through most of them. He always had standby counsel. I think it's, you know, it's Mr. Davis is not a terrific lawyer. He hasn't been to law school. I think that there's significant concerns there. But
no, if you've been around the system long enough, you usually pick it up.
Right, right. Well, and we encounter plenty of lawyers in the penitentiary. But that doesn't relieve the government of its obligations under the plea agreement. That's the basic point. I think the government's waived any argument that Mr. Davis somehow breached the plea agreement. The other clarification I wanted to make concerned the first sentencing hearing. The government basically said, we think that Mr. Davis is in violation of his proffer agreement, which means that we can now violate the plea agreement. But those are two separate agreements. The proffer agreement is, you know, an agreement between the parties. I don't think it's in the record. I've seen a copy of it, but I don't think it's in the record. Saying, you'll give information, it'll be protected, it won't be used against you. In return, you can't contest it. But I don't see any basis in the plea agreement where it would say, if you violate the proffer agreement, now we can tear apart the plea agreement. So the government breached. They didn't cure unequivocally, so we would ask for the court to remand to allow Mr. Davis to withdraw his guilty plea.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. O'Neill?
May it please the court. Excuse me. I am Assistant United States Attorney Erica O'Neill. I represented the United States of America both here and in the case below. Mr. Davis entered his...
Could you pull the microphone just towards you?
This one? Thank you.
Just pull it towards you.
Oh, thank you.
There you go.
Mr. Maurice Davis entered a guilty plea in October of 2011 and spent most of the next year trying to get out of the plea. As counsel for Mr. Davis referenced, allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, coercion, collusion. He fired his first attorney, obtained a second attorney, who then became standby counsel. And in fact, by the morning of the first sentencing, the first part of that morning was taken up by a two-hour motion for Mr. Davis to be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea that Judge Clivert ultimately denied. And then sentencing commenced. I acknowledge and I agree absolutely with defense counsel that this is a very, very ugly record involving three sentencing hearings, not to mention the year of litigation that preceded it. And I also have to acknowledge absolutely poor math on my part, as well as frustration with the defendant's repeated denials of guilt post-plea. There is one correction to the record that I believe I must make, and that is that at the morning of the first sentencing hearing in October of 2012, Mr. Davis did, in fact, deny guilt. And that was where I believe the wheels began to fall off the wagon. And I would like to reference the sentencing transcript. It is page 11 of the first sentencing transcript, document number 272 in the record. At the bottom of that page, the court is trying to elicit from defense counsel how much cocaine base do you believe you are responsible for, what parts of the pre-sentence report do you object to, and Mr. Davis very clearly said there is no cocaine base. And that is a huge problem in this case because Mr. Davis pled guilty to distributing, agreed to a conspiracy involving 28 grams or more of crack cocaine in the form of cocaine base. As soon as Mr. Davis says there is no cocaine base, we no longer have an offense that he is pleading guilty to. And as I indicated, that's where I believe the wheels began to fall off the wagon in this case, because the court, Judge Clavert, then ordered the government to lay out its government version of the offense, cooperator by cooperator. This was a purely historical conspiracy case built on the debriefs of co-conspirators as well as co-defendants. And Judge Clavert ordered the court to lay out that information that would relate to the government version of the offense. Now, defense counsel in this case has indicated that the government conflates paragraph 17 and 18 of the plea agreement. The simple fact of the matter is that 17 and 18 go hand in hand. The government view in this case is that defense counsel conflates paragraph 17 of the plea agreement with the government's obligation of candor to the court. That is found, among other places, in Title 18 United States Code, Section 3661, which indicates that no limit shall be placed on the information concerning the conduct of the defendant that may be brought to the, that must be brought to the attention of the sentencing court. And similarly, plea agreement paragraph 21 reserves the right to inform the court by the government of all of the conduct. And in this case, Judge Clavert, in attempting to fully address the defendant's concerns and get to the bottom of this situation to make a good record, ordered the government to prepare that revised version of the defense when the defendant came to court in October and said, I object to every single paragraph of the pre-sentence report. There is no cocaine base. And so the government did exactly as it was ordered to. However, then at the second sentencing, and I have this in my brief, but I will recite it for the record because I believe it's very important in terms of the unequivocal curing of the breach. Giving Mr. Benefit the benefit of every doubt and taking the lowest possible quantity that one of the co-conspirators had put on him, the government is going to recommend the relevant conduct to be 252 grams, clearly within both paragraphs 17 and 18 of the plea agreement. Unfortunately, sentencing still did not end at that second hearing in December of 2012, and we had to come back in April of 2013. And by that time, the government and defense counsel, standby counsel, had looked at it and realized that there was a math error. And again, the government believes that its obligation of candor to the court is absolutely paramount. Acknowledge that error. Unfortunately, I have been a prosecutor for 13 years. I have made these errors before. I will probably make them in the future. However, in standing by that obligation of candor, the government still fulfilled the promise of the plea agreement, saying, take a number that is consistent with our recommendation, please, judge. And take a sentencing recommendation that is not only consistent with our plea agreement, but lower, 10 months lower than the bottom of the guideline range that was called for in the plea agreement. And so, therefore, the government believes that this case, unlike Diaz-Jimenez, I apologize, the cure of the breach was unequivocal. The court here agreed and sentenced the defendant accordingly.
But along the way, there was a great deal of discussion about this Deontay Diaz and how much cocaine base he could put on the defendant.
Yes.
And a reference to 512 grams.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my math error.
Before the...
Yes, I had... What
before
I,
the cure.
Exactly. That was my math error. I had believed that Deontay Diaz had said we got 63 grams of crack cocaine together four times. And in fact, what happened is that Deontay Diaz, in reading more carefully, which I should have done sooner, said we got 63 grams we paid for, and at the same time we got 63 grams on a front for 126 grams. And we did that, 126 grams, four times. And that was exactly my math error, is that I took 63 times 4 versus 126 times 4.
Right, and during that portion of the transcript, there's an invitation to the judge to use that number.
Well, I don't...
It was sort of, I'll stick with my recommendation, but judge, you should feel free to go ahead and use that number.
Your Honor, I don't like asking the court to make a finding that is inconsistent with the record. And so I was treading very carefully and perhaps not carefully enough at that point.
Right. I mean, it's a dilemma. You've got to be candid with the court about what the evidence shows, and particularly when ordered to produce it.
Exactly.
But you have to abide by your agreement at the same time.
Yes.
The court was evidently trying to also walk that line without inducing a breach.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor.
That's how I read this transcript. And then eventually imposed the sentence that was bargained for. And actually a sentence 10 months below what was bargained for.
That is exactly correct, Your Honor.
We've got an issue about harmless error review and whether that's permissible in this context under Santabello.
That would be the government's argument here, is that it is a harmless error because under a specific performance standard, Mr. Davis has not only gotten what he bargained for, he has gotten more than what he has bargained for. And so the government's view is that whether it's a harmless error standard, a plain error standard, or even de novo review, Mr. Davis has gotten the benefit of his bargain, and therefore this case should be affirmed on appeal. If there are no further questions, I will see the rest
Thank
of
you,
my
counsel.
Time. Thank you.
You have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I do always appreciate the United States Attorney being candid to the court. That's obviously something we appreciate. But the dilemma here is, if you have a duty to be candid to the court, but you've agreed to something else, you need to somehow disavow the plea agreement. You need to reach out to the defendant and say, we've got a problem here. I feel that my duty is to be candid to the court, but I know that I agreed to this recommendation. Can we resolve that on our own, or am I going to have to seek to get out of this agreement? And I think the government thought it could do both. It could walk the line, and I'm not sure there is a line where the government's forcefully arguing for 512 grams, and the plea agreement says that they won't do that. What was bargained for here was not a 120-month sentence. That would be a different agreement. What was bargained for was the appearance of Mr. Davis as somebody involved with drugs in a certain quantity. Certainly, we're going to penalize those who trade in kilos more than we do those in grams. That was the bargain. The other thing I would say about, again, the innocence, the government suggests on page 11, he actually said, I'm not guilty. He didn't, whether it's powder or crack is not an element of the offense under 841A. It's just that it's a controlled substance.
He may have thought it was.
Well, what I think he thought was that under the guidelines, they should be treated the same. I think legal counsel would have suggested there's no reason for a disparity between these two, especially if he's getting it in powder form. But I don't see that as somehow renouncing his guilt. Again, the government mentions trying to cure the breach at the second hearing, but then it breached again at the third hearing, and that's far from unequivocal. So for those reasons, we'd ask to reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsels. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.
If we can do that. Yeah.